Often, even if I say, let's do a creative workshop, most of the tech people, 2/3 of the people in an IT company tell, oh no, I can't draw. Wait, you do not need to be able to draw to be creative.
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the award-winning tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats. Ooh, we have a treat for you this week with our guest, Martina Mitz, UX psychologist, strategist, and designer. Great titles.
In this episode, can cybersecurity teams flex their creativity to keep us all safe? The first of two parts, we're going to talk about the natural intersection between psychology, UX, and cybersecurity, and the importance of understanding human behavior to create user-centric digital interfaces that people will not only want to interact with, but will also keep them safe.
We're also going to discuss the importance of bridging the gap between cybersecurity and UX teams, building trust between two teams that are often perceived at odds with each other, or they may not even interact at all.
And finally, whether or not cybersecurity could, or maybe even should, be considered a creative pursuit. Well, we love this chat and we think you will do too. So sit back and enjoy our interview with Martina Mitz.
Hi, welcome to the show. We have got a very, very special guest on today. I met Martina at the Webinale in Berlin in May this year, and her talk absolutely blew me away. And this podcast idea has been going around for a while, and we've been slowly picking up guests thinking, yeah, that person will be really good. And Martina is definitely one of them. Martina, will you introduce yourself?
First, thank you so much. It's like, oh my gosh. Yeah, good start. So to introduce myself, it's always like, can you do it shortly? It's really hard to do it shortly because, guys, I kind of come from clinical psychology. I've studied as a psychologist before bachelor and master's even, so a diploma psychologist. I kind of went into that direction of pursuing clinical psychology for not even a year. But long before that, even last century, so when I arrived to Berlin, to Germany, I actually started teaching myself web design. So fast forward, like 10 years later, when I kind of finished studying German and psychology in German and English, thankfully, and English, I was like, okay, these things belong together. It's like the whole creating something for people has ultimately to do with psychology because it's people. So fast forward another 10, meanwhile, 15 years later, I call myself UX psychology. UX stands for user experience, for the listeners who don't know that, or if there is anyone not knowing that. So I've kind of come to combine these two and emphasize a lot on understanding the people who we as companies, organizations, states. I was even thinking today, the kids of a person are their users. So like even to that extent, even as parents, if you wish, for the things we do, we need to really understand the people we do it for. So that's in a nutshell me kind of trying to understand people.
Amazing. So user research and psychology together. It seems like very natural kind of bedfellows there. It kind of, why isn't that more of a thing? Why isn't that everywhere? Why isn't every kind of tech organization got a Martina in there?
Thank you. Well, that was, to be honest with you, because it was a no-brainer as a psychologist that you kind of can do great service, you can interview people. So when I had my burnout after not even a year of pursuing clinical psychology or psychotherapy even, I was like, okay, wait, there was a company in Berlin. Only one, actually, because back then it was advertising agencies, guys, or digital agency wasn't even that much of a thing in like 2008 and 9. So there was one agency that was really specialized from market research into user research. And everybody was like, you're a psychologist, you need to go there. But I was like, I just finished a diploma like a year ago. I still remember that thing with like a longitudinal study and writing a lot. And that company was up to that stage, it was writing reports. So to be honest with you, Liane, at the beginning, I actually kind of defended myself. I went fully hands-on. I went through visual design and really interaction design. And I was like, you guys do the research. Like, I'll help you. We can talk into conceptualizing it. I love doing that pre-work with the researchers, but then they'll do the, I'll just observe, you know? So yeah, it was a no-brainer. But when I applied at advertising agencies, and I'm so sorry I didn't get to record the reactions I got back. It was like, but you're a psychologist. And I was like, yeah, well, thank you for the information. Like, I know.
I think tech companies are getting a bit more hip and wise to the skills that, that people in the humanities can give to the tech industry now, especially sort of the big tech companies. Do you know what I really loved was the story you shared at Webinale about the website you helped build and how you kind of, you're almost a bit kind of marketing salesy in the way you approached that. It was for a beauty service.
You remember this one, yeah?
I do, yeah. It was great. Story. All your whole talk was brilliant. I wish we had time for you to go through it all, but I'm sure if you have any links to the video version, we can definitely share it. But yeah, your journey into that. I really liked that story. It really kind of exemplified identifying a user need and giving it to them, even when they weren't aware that they had a need.
Yeah. Well, that was really, I think I'll never forget this one. I just needed like two words from you to mention, and I know what you're talking about, because it was my first kind of really big jumping over my shadow, right? Because I was self-taught. I was a foreigner. My German wasn't like business level at all. And then imagine me with like two pink ponytails, pretty much early 20s. I really didn't have the stuff to go and sell. So that jumping over the shadow, that was actually really big growth moment, right? Because exactly as you said, I offered something that the person didn't know they needed, and they needed to, because they had a website. It was like, oh my gosh, it was really eye cancer, guys. You know, it's like fishes jumping over the text and bubbles, like early 2000s, right? It was like you couldn't even.
I can picture it.
Text, yeah. For the listeners, it was like really early 2000 worst websites chart leader, pretty much. But yeah, and for that client to really sleep two nights over and say like, oh wait, for the people I'm serving, what she's offering is actually exactly what I need, because I went with the words of the people she was serving, right? But as I also admitted here few months ago at Webinale, guys, it was, for me, it was not user-centered at all. It was just like I needed some confidence boost to go and say like, I want to talk to the manager and try to sell something to the manager as well, right? And be like, give me your money. No. Yeah, I love that you remember this one, because it's big for me as well.
No, I love that story. I thought it was a really good story. Well, your whole talk was brilliant, which is why you're on the show. Speaking of stories, it got me thinking that there's something we had a chat about when we were prepping this episode, and it was literally a day or two, this event that happened to me, it was a day or two after we called you up, and I was like, let me tell you about what just happened to me a few days ago. It was about my interaction with a user researcher team, and as a security person and someone who used to be a software developer, I really, really value the work that user researchers and user experience teams do. I think it's, what's the point of building anything unless you engage that team, in my opinion, because you just never know if you're going to hit the mark or anything like that. You could just be building a load of rubbish. That doesn't appeal to anyone or anything like that. Now, normally I reach out to the user researcher team quite early on when I join an organization. However, due to the nature of where I'm working at the moment, I've been so busy, so it's taken a lot longer. But I reached out to them and I was like, oh hi, can I have a coffee with you? And they were like, oh, security team has just messaged me, and the first thing they said to me is, what have I done wrong? Am I in trouble? And all I wanted to do was just, you know, have a coffee with them, find out about the work they were doing, see if perhaps we could do some user research on the security journey and things like that. And nope, their immediate thought was, and I probably should have guessed this, was, am I in trouble? What have I done wrong? And my question for you then is, it made me feel a bit bad, but I understood where they were coming from. Should the cybersecurity team think about engaging with the UX team?
Like, Liane, when you told me that story, I was like, oh my gosh, you are the first person I hear actually doing that. And it's absolutely like, why haven't we? Why hasn't anyone before you? Like, you remember my first reaction was like, oh, people were scared, they've done something wrong. And then they probably thought like, are you all right?
Yes, I think they did think I'd lost my marbles. Yeah.
So you're kind of a unicorn with that understanding, I would say. Still, of course, a lot is changing there through a lot of case study, but it's still that really, when you're deeply convinced that you need to know who you are doing something for and really understand them well, well, you don't meet that very often, especially from the cybersecurity team, right? So even me, as like, we're talking on the same level, guys, and I told you, and we talked before, and you took away the fear from me of not being a cybersecurity specialist or having even had a project or even a colleague of yours in my workshops or sessions, so I can really make it super relatable. You taking that fear away from me, it seems to be so deeply ingrained when you hear cybersecurity to first think of like, oh my gosh, I'm in trouble, right? That it still kind of stays on. So I love that story that you said. And I totally, since then, I've been thinking so often about it, that it's definitely, you guys have some work to do and you won't be able to really do it well. That taking away the fear, really conveying the importance of everything you do, you won't be able to do it without that understanding where the fears lie and how deep they are, right?
That's a good point. So you think that's one of the first things that, say, you know, people listening to this podcast of a cybersecurity people are like, actually, that is a good idea. I do want to reach out to my user researcher, user experience team. You think the first step is actually getting over the fear of them showing up at their door or whatever?
Well, first expect them to be like, oh my gosh, what have I done wrong? So maybe even start with taking that fear away, like, hey, I am the security person. You've done nothing wrong. I just want to talk, like, don't run away. I'm kidding. But reach out and expect for them to first be very, very surprised, right? Because the research team is there to help you understand. But as I said, most of them have never had a stakeholder like you who comes from cybersecurity. So they'll not know what to deliver first, where to help you. So just kind of reach out, like reach that hand and start making the connection and kind of explaining how you guys were kind of taking away, because it's partially the fear of the unknown that plays a role here, right? For all of us other humans, I don't want to say normal, but you guys know what I mean. For all us other humans, cybersecurity is something super complicated that you only hear about when it really goes wrong, right?
True. Yeah.
And for you is a day-to-day, it's a different understanding. You grasp the complexity differently. So if you can break down that for say the researchers, the designers, even to show them it, like, it doesn't have to bite, and it's something that is actually crucial. And remember when we talked, because I've kind of had that example of yours, I was like, oh my gosh, how would I have reacted if I was a part of the team, or if a security person, cybersecurity, came to my team back in the years when I was heading a team and they were like, hi, I'm the security. Hi, I'm Leanne. I'm the cybersecurity person. Seriously, for a second, my heart will drop to my heels. It's just, I guess we are primed that way. So yeah, it totally needs that understanding how to take away the fear of the unknown, how to make it known, graspable. And remember, we actually put that comparison to accessibility. Accessibility was, I think it's also getting more and more understood that it's like not this only people we need or like elderly people or whatever, but it's kind of that term is being more broadly understood, and people are not in that clinical scenarios always when they think about accessibility. I think same path is, at least from my perception, in front of cybersecurity, because it's like, oh my gosh, it's just when you hear it, it's like,
People don't like compliance in general. If it's just treated as a compliance exercise and a governance and like a truncheon, you know, like a steel rod, rather than it being like a collaborative effort.
I love to call it the necessary evil, you know, like filling out
start.
A form or stuff like that. If you consider it like that, then yes, it will always be like, oh, you guys deal with it, right? Mm. It's not like it's not my thing. We'll get an expert to deal with it.
You also mentioned that cybersecurity practitioners never really go to any of your workshops. I guess, why do you think that is, and what do you think they're missing out on not being there? I mean, after all, when a developer attends your workshops, it kind of enables them to be more efficient in what they build, because they're actually going to be building something that the customer wants and won't need to be reworked.
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, I was thinking about that, Jeff. Is it the kinds of workshops that I make? Because it's always like that, trying to get the people who have bits and pieces from an organization or business big picture, businesses big picture. So I try to get really these department heads or stuff like that that have this wider overview. However, we've also, like, I've done these sessions and these alignment workshops and big picture with quite big companies who had a lot of like financial stuff or like really a lot of security stuff. And I'm not sure what the answer is, that we never go into that really detail, that it's me trying to push in that direction. But even back then, when I worked on designs and wireframes and really financial businesses solutions, I seriously never met a cybersecurity person unless it was about getting a new badge or, you know, like really some very practical security stuff, even like physical security stuff, which was, it's strange. It seems like you're, at least my perception in the companies where I've been, it's even you guys sit in a different room, as in like separated from the whole. It's like some commando center that, you know, it's like very, a lot of that veil of the unknown around what you do.
It doesn't help. I think being, I've worked in organizations, and there is reasons for it sometimes to be literally segregated off from the rest of the organization. But, you know, you can still come out and engage in the communal areas and things like that, introduce yourself. I wonder if, you know, when I'm thinking about your workshops, and they sound amazing, I'd love to be invited to one. I wonder if it's because cybersecurity teams and the word innovation and creativity don't really normally go hand in hand, but I think they can be. Do you think the cybersecurity teams can be innovative and creative?
Well, I think it's a crucial part of actually being good at being innovative and creative, to be honest with you. But the mental model is pretty much that it's probably gonna be rather someone who is pulling back from innovation and creativity, you know, because it's always that perception of, oh, to be innovative and creative, you need to go wild, which is actually not the case at all. You just need to know very well what you are solving for whom. And then solutions start falling your way and you start seeing which ones make sense. But I think because it's perceived as that going wild, and then security, just the word is like something bringing it super to the heart, reality bottom, super quickly, you know? So even in my head, guys, although it's an integral part, and when I think about it and we talk about it, of course it is. Like, we can think of great things and then you come and say, well, here with the data, we need to be considerate, so it maybe it's not gonna work at all. And it's like, oh, why didn't we talk to you like 3 months ago when we were even conceiving the idea, right? So even though I realize it's an integral part, guys, my instinct would have also been like, oh, you'll be that, what is it called? You spoil the game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's sometimes when I do a talk, I talk about cybersecurity teams are sometimes like the kids that have been invited to the party by the parent, not by the child, just to kind of be included. Like, no, you've got to invite them. You've got to invite, I don't care if you don't like them. You've got to invite them to the party, and they just kind of stand in the corner going, nobody's talking to me.
Absolutely great metaphor, yeah.
I also think, I think you are right in the sense that we had a guest on another podcast called Matt Ballantyne, and he was talking about how sometimes in certain organizations that work, any kind of fun element added to work is seen as like, that's not real work. And so sometimes I think any kind of creative or innovative speak week is seen as a connection to actually having fun, which is, hopefully it is fun. It's nice to work somewhere that's fun. But there's always that kind of understanding that if something's too fun, then it's not work, which is totally not true. With cybersecurity people, sometimes I feel like my job is so serious. I'm protecting the organization. My job is so serious. And when you're in that mindset, it can be hard to kind of break out a role.
And I think that's exactly, you kind of probably hit it on the spot, because this is what I would say, not just mine, but like the wider perception of you guys, which is totally wrong, because I also remember roughly your talk from webinar, and it was like, oh my gosh, of course it's everybody's thing. Of course it should be. Like, it was so, like, why haven't we talked before, right? It was that mind open, like, bam, on the head. Like, why haven't I reached out to cybersecurity? Although I even had a boyfriend who was cybersecurity. Like, but haven't considered it at all as a field that's relevant. And you guys really opened my eyes. And it totally, yeah, it totally is that stereotype of the, like, super dry, never smiling person who always come with like raised finger and tell you you've done something wrong. You shouldn't have.
I think that this is like an almost like a polarization of not only the fun, but also the creatives versus the non-creatives. You imagine people sat in gray shirts and suits and ties in cybersecurity, and you expect people playing hacky sack or basketball in the office and sitting on beanbags in the UX department. Like, there is a lot of, I think, image and marketing polarization that people in UX maybe can't think about things in like kind of business oriented kind of way, and people in security can't be creative.
I've actually, Jeff, I've gone through that pitfall of like mistake of thinking myself, to be honest with you, because I exactly started in UX from very hands-on, from UI design, then through really interaction design, information architecture, all this super hands-on stuff where you push pixels. And then like 3-4 years later, I started being a part of these alignment workshops where we talk about big picture. And then there is like hours and days spent without me having pushed the pixel and me facilitating processes where I'm not even able to contribute with ideas while I'm facilitating ideation, right? So it really kind of for a while felt like I'm being robbed of my creativity. Now I'm just a manager, you know, from one meeting to another meeting and then from workshop to workshop and just like pushing pixels in Keynote and PowerPoint. Yay. Like, and in the calendar app, that was the most visual thing I would do for weeks. And then that's exactly what is our understanding of creativity, right? So often, even if I say, let's do a creative workshop, most of the tech people, more like 2/3 of the people in an IT company tell, oh no, I can't draw.
Yes. Yeah.
Wait, you do not need to be able to draw to be creative. Yeah, you can be linguistically creative, you can be cognitively creative. It's like, it's okay. And I'm sure you can draw like a cat or something that we all understand, or a house, or like a human with like stick, what is it called? Stick human. So absolutely, that's, we have two misunderstandings here, guys, right? That polarization of analytical, dry, like super hard reality against creative. But then also you need to be like that, guys, to do your work well, which is totally not the case. I'm sure you have some creating challenges in your work as well, right?
Yeah, I take quite a lot of cybersecurity. You have to have a creative mindset, even if it's not recognized either by the people doing the job in cybersecurity or the people from the outside. You have to solve problems creatively, because a hacker could come in one way and it might not be something you've never seen before. Like, how did they get in this way? And trying to figure out, not just from an analytical point of view, but actually, how do we creatively spot this in the future? How do we creatively solve this problem? And, you know, when most of the problems that happen in cybersecurity are from the human element, you have to be creative, because you're dealing with sentient beings that are unpredictable, that have all this cultural baggage around them and everything like that. You can't be analytical when it comes to the human, because humans are not robots. If they were, my job would be very easy, but they're not. So you need to have that creative understanding of that people are not going to respond in the way that you think they're going to respond. So therefore, the controls you create can't be rigid.
Exactly. And I love that you're saying it. It's like really honey to my ears. And again, I don't think that all of your colleagues, let me be like more diplomatic, that all of your colleagues are your opinion, unfortunately. But Leanne, like if you would have come to me while I was in a company, I would have probably after that initial talk, just shock, just jumped and hugged you and like, oh my gosh, you stay here because I need you. So having that mindset really already takes away that just reaching out and saying, hey, it is about people, and it definitely is. And you are doing actually a quite similar work because you're trying to stay proactive and predict human needs and behavior, right? Which is exactly what we in UX are supposed to do as well, right? Try to kind of really understand
it. I think that collaboration would be so good because, and this is my next question, why is it so important to understand the experience of our customers? Because one thing I think that, what I love about, and you know, I've been very lucky to watch the interview process, you know, when we've built something, and then this is when I was a software developer, we've built something, and then I don't know if they still do it by two-way mirror, but they did where I used to work. Watch a customer literally interact, and the questions the user experience team used to ask were so incredible. I think we could learn in cybersecurity so much from those questions about how people respond to security control. So my question is for you, just to kind of remind you, because I went on a ramble, is why is it important to understand the experience of the customers, and what skills can we learn from that?
That's a great question, to be honest with you. And it's not even just about the experience, because the experience is we go through something and then whatever we save as memory and emotions, so subconsciously, that's actually the experience. And we usually pack it consciously into a story or imaging with it and stuff like that. But it's not, because the experience changes based on factors. So what makes user research, or actually I would even say psychology here, so exciting and so fundamental, that there are pretty much more or less throughout time stable fundamentals that do not change that often as does our behavior. Because I love this one thing. I would go on a ramble, so remind me back on the question if I go too much. Seriously, guys, this one thing when someone comes and says, oh, I'm an extrovert. And I'm like, well, you're an extrovert now, but I surely can show you a situation where you are. So we are on a scale and with a lot of our behaviors, but we are not so often so fluctuating on such a dynamic scale when it's about our mental models, our character, our types of personality. And these structures, yes, they're much more bigger picture. They don't give you a super detailed, concrete behavior that you can act against or kind of be proactive for, but they give you kind of these probabilities of future behavior, right? So when you know someone's perception of the world, perception of hacking, even like what do they do it primarily for? What are they trying to achieve in life? No matter how bright their spectrum, how long-term their spectrum for life is, because for some people in survival, it's just tomorrow. For people who have covered basic existential needs, it's maybe 2, 5, 10 years ahead. And when you get to that, what world are they living in their heads, and what are they trying to achieve for themselves in that world they perceive, then you can be longer term proactive, because this most of these structures just don't change like from month to month, let's say, because the past 3-4 years, we've been living in a very dynamic time. So yes. I would say, yes, in the past 3-4 years, every year you should do a bit of a refresh of the understanding that you have of people, because a lot changed and it changed very quickly. But still, these super fundamental structures in our heads, in each and everyone's head of what world we live in, they still haven't changed completely, or like really 180 degrees at least, right? And that is exactly what I'm kind of aiming for, and is, I think, absolutely also kind of a fundament for all these processes of how do people perceive the world and themselves into it. And then that's really the, okay, yeah, we thought people might do that, but it's actually much more probable that they would stay on the other side of the spectrum given this situation and that context. Yeah.
Sounds like a behavioral Markov chain.
A Markov chain? What's a Markov chain?
It's like a graph where you move through different states and there's a percentage of probability that you'll move from one state to another. And they use that in algorithms. And they kind of, I imagine they're talking about what's the probability of a user moving to a next behavior based on what you know.
Yeah.
I imagine what you're saying is, like you say, it's almost like times tables. Do people become almost quite predictable en masse?
That I wouldn't say, because we're very ambiguous, and that makes us actually exciting as subjects. For observation. This is how psychologists call human, right? It's like when we talk super scientific, it's like the subjects of a species. So that makes us exciting, Jeff, that we're actually, and that I loved, Leanne, that you mentioned that we're not that well predictable, right? You can't really say, oh, that person is going to do that with that certainty. But from a world of possibilities, it just excludes a big part. You don't have to think it all, but it kind of points your thinking into what's most probable. Still, you have the individual cases, the outliers that teach you differently, right? That's why I love user research, guys, because it's one of the few cases where it's like someone proves me wrong. And I'm like, yes, because sometimes you come to like think you know it all, right? You've seen it all, especially from a certain age on. You're like, oh, these youngsters, jokingly. But you're like, you feel like, oh my gosh, I've seen it all, being over 15 years in the field, right? It's like nothing can surprise. And then comes the next user and you're like, all right, I assumed something, but actually listening to the end and going deep. And I had to understand it's a totally different person, totally different background, totally different perception of the world and their goal, their role and goals in it. So yeah, that's exciting.
You've just kind of like fired like a ping, ping, ping synapses. When you were talking about that, is being happy to have your expectations challenged is such a skill. And it's such a skill that I think cybersecurity professionals could really learn, because as I kind of alluded to earlier, we think, okay, if we train enough people not to click on that, they won't click on it. But people do, because humans are not predictable. And, you know, there's lots of different factors that will mean they'll click on something, even if you give them the best training you could ever think of. This training doesn't exist, by the way. There's no foolproof training to train against clicking on malicious emails or anything like that. But imagine there was. Imagine the world there was. But
even, you know, that factor of like, don't click there.
Yeah,
you make people. We have that child. You make people even more.
It's the red button that says "Don't click the red button." You're like, I must click the red button.
You know, there was a website like that, I think, which made like "Don't click here," and then it made you click 99 times to close a pop-up, which they told you, "Well, you should have this," something like that. A job.
Wow, what a cracking episode. I love having UX people on the show.
Me too.
So, do you think that we all can or maybe should be more creative in our work, specifically in cybersecurity?
I think we should definitely start showing up with our paintbrushes and start painting the town red. Red and blue for the red and blue team. But I definitely think solving security challenges requires creative and innovative thinking and a deeper understanding of human behaviour.
Yeah, and Martina's background and her finding that natural intersection herself between psychology and UX was really eye-opening. It makes me wonder, should we be leaning more into the intersection between psychology and cybersecurity?
I think the intersection should be happening all over the place. So far during these last few seasons, we've seen it's cybersecurity and it's usually something like and psychology and user research and anthropology, things like that, behavioral science as well. I think it's really important that we get all different kinds of human-centric backgrounds in to consider the big bad world of cybersecurity and the attacks we're facing.
Amen to that. Well, links to everything Martina discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. Before you close the app you're listening to, take a millisecond to drop us a 5-star rating. You have no idea how much this pleases the algorithm gods and gets our show to a wider audience.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and we can't wait to join you for next week for part 2. But for now, see you next time, keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I in the compromising position here?